Okay, so I have indeed been talking to the other camp, to Jim Peebles in particular, and we had different different starting points, but we wound up with some overlap in our interests. My starting point was thinking about late time behavior, the Brandenburger-Waffe scenario, by which I mean what could be going on today as a result of the strings that might be left over from the early phase of this scenario. And I'll be a little more detailed in the next transparency. More specifically, could these strings that wind the extra dimension or have momentums on the momenta on the extra dimensions, could they stabilize the modulus? That's something that Brandenburger has proposed and worked on. And I'll indicate a new twist on that question. Could we envision dark matter being such objects? Or more generally, could we imagine some massive objects in a less well-specified theory with some scalar interactions that would mimic the interactions between these winding momentum strings that arise through string moduli? And finally, most generally perhaps, what are the consequences of a long-range scalar interaction among dark matter particles? And that, of course, that last question is something with a fair bit of literature behind it in cosmology, which I'll, you know, barely be able to reference properly. So let me just get straight to a brief reminder of the Brandenburger-Waffe scenario. In this scenario, you suppose that at early times, all dimensions were small, perhaps at the string scale, and for a very simplistic starting point, we could have a T9 as the spatial dimensions, where all the S1s of the T9 are at the self-dual radius. Then you suppose that everything you could imagine is thermally excited. So you have wrapping strings around every homology cycle. You have momentum strings in every direction. If you have brains in your theory, then you would also have brains wrapping these dimensions. But it turns out that they matter less for the story than the strings, so I'll just focus on the strings. So no doubt you've heard this earlier, since I know Robert was here, but the basic point of the Brandenburger-Waffe paper was that there is a preference for three large dimensions and six small. And the reason is that if you imagine starting with these nine small dimensions, then if you let several of them grow, three is special because it's the most dimensions that can keep growing in the following sense. If three dimensions start to grow, then the strings that wind them can annihilate efficiently because generically strings moving in three dimensions will cross. When they cross, they can interact, they can annihilate one another. Whereas if you had four dimensions starting to expand, the strings wrapping them would not annihilate so efficiently, and so the thought is that the winding strings would rope them back in to their self-dual radius. So the bottom line is this is a way of selecting three large dimensions via some dynamical mechanism.
Can you remind us to what extent this was supported by an actual calculation? Because this is sort of a picture, but for example, if you wrap a brain over a torus, it doesn't pull it back in. That X is a cosmological constant in the expansion.
Yeah, there are some problems. I don't disagree. For instance, another part of their story is that you avoid an initial singularity via T-duality. Your circles are growing smaller and smaller, and then when they get to the string scale, you T-dualize them so they're getting larger. Well, if you actually calculate, as was done, I think, in papers, for instance, of Copeland, Lahiri, and Wands, what you find is that if you run time backwards, after you've T-dualized, those dimensions grow very, very fast. Infinitely fast, so that you actually do encounter a curvature singularity, but for very unusual, well, not the usual reasons. It's not because you're getting small too fast, it's because you're getting big too fast in the far past. So yes, there are definitely problems. I'm going to just duck them all because I want to talk about something that is only loosely motivated by this, which is, what if in the universe today one of these moduli remained unfixed and we have some of these winding and momentum strings still floating around? How might it change the CDM model? That's really the topic of the talk. Okay, so let's nevertheless follow this Brandenburger-Vapa development a hair further. Yes.
Can I ask one more question about this general idea? Does this really depend on the fundamental group being Z? In other words,
you want a discrete.
That on a Calabi-Yau you might have non-contractible cycles, but because the fundamental group is finite, that you wouldn't have to have the strings meet to annihilate.
Well, I would say that if you just had Z2 as a fundamental group, then the winding strings should still be there. And in fact, a paper of Green and collaborators argues that even if there is no pi 1, these strings can live long enough to do their job.
In that paper, we mentioned exactly that point that you just said.
Okay, so.
All right, so I will nevertheless stick with conventional ideas, and you'll see that I'm really motivated to think about something that I could say without all this string theory setup. I'm just putting it in familiar terms, the Brandenburger-Vapa scenario, perhaps. So at late times, we've decompactified three of these dimensions. The strings winding along those three dimensions have efficiently annihilated, but we're left with some of these guys moving around the T6 and some of these guys wrapping around the T6. And the suggestion is perhaps we could let at least some of the moduli of this compact manifold remain unfixed, except as they may get fixed through a presence of these things. That's the purported stabilization mechanism that Brandenburger suggested. Again, dynamical rather than having to rely on vacuum physics.
So the momentum modes have spin scale momentum?
Yes, they're Kaluza Klein modes. So if we just have a circle compactification, to be really simplistic, then of course they have to have one unit or two units of Kaluza Klein momentum. These things are heavy. They're up at the Planck scale. The only way we could imagine bringing them down from the Planck scale in this setup is we could replace these fundamental strings by some very light strings. Imagine, for instance, little strings propagating in six dimensions, two of which are compact. Then we can bring the scale down. But that's the only way. Okay, so now let me get to what I'll really do. I will not do string theory. That's why I said string inspired. I will simply consider some action with gravity, a scalar. I'll put in a potential just to show how the effects of these masses sort of mimic a potential. But at the end of the day, what I really want is to say V equals zero for, as I say, at least some of the moduli. And, well, this is motivated by just a bit of contrariness in my makeup. Now that we know we can stabilize all moduli, I'd say, well, maybe we shouldn't be quite so hasty. At any rate, let's just consider this coupled, this scalar phi, coupled to many particles with their individual world lines, gamma. And these particles may have some dependence on the scalar. Well, in our Brandenburger-Vapa picture, we would know what this dependence is. The masses of momentum modes are bigger if you make the circles smaller, whereas the masses of the winding modes are smaller as you make the circle smaller. And we can be precise, and we will be soon. Okay, so we would like to ask how does structure form with this action? And the way we go about our business is to...
What's the mass of this data?
As I wanted to emphasize from the start, this is here only to give you some analogy between the effects of a potential. But really what I want to, the effects of a potential and the effects of the mass. But really what I want to do is consider V equals zero, identically zero.
So it's massless.
Indeed. Not only massless, but with a vanishing potential. I don't even want 5/4 around, because that would really change the story.
Steve, your 5 lives on the whole real line, or their different pieces are identified by some duality transformation?
Doesn't matter. I will have phi varying by a tiny fraction of M Planck. Like minus 10 to the minus 4 M Planck would be the natural variation of phi. So this is a little like, well, this starting point is a little like quintessence, except that I really want V equals zero. I want a very light scalar coupling to dark matter. And really, I guess that was really more Jim Peebles' starting point. He said, quintessence is fun, but why should we have a dark sector which is kind of made of two wholly disjoint things? On one hand, a quintessence field, and on the other hand, dark matter. The dark sector, maybe we should treat it as one unified structure with quintessence fields coupling to dark matter. So that was his starting point.
In his model, we needed this field to couple only to dark matter.
We'll discuss a little bit coupling to the visible sector. Obviously, you have to be careful how you couple it to the visible sector, or you'll violate the equivalence principle.
So your Q here is only dark, the dark sector?
Yes. So I want to violate the equivalence principle strongly in the dark sector. That'd be another way.
And zero coupling to the visible. The way you wrote it.
Dimension, also, what I'll say later is dimension 6 couplings only to the visible sector, which I find tolerable if the scalar doesn't roll. It's hard to imagine how that could possibly be if the scalar does roll. So, well, I'll discuss a little later in what ways my setup is unnatural, but since it seems to be almost at the surface of questions already asked, I'll just say that what's unnatural here indeed is to have the mass really be zero after supersymmetry breaking. Let me just return to that. Before supersymmetry breaking, of course, there would be nothing particularly unnatural about this. We just have this be part of some globally supersymmetric theory. And so my feeling generally is to violate concepts of naturalness after supersymmetry breaking is not a great sin, because we know we do that anyway. All right, so let's return to calculations. How do we actually do structure formation with a scalar coupled to many massive particles? We do some hydrodynamic approximation and linearized perturbation theory. And the way it goes is you have some number currents for the different species. So here, capital Q indexes every single particle, and lowercase q just tells you what species they are. So for instance, I could say Q equals 1 for the winding strings and Q equals 2 for the momentum strings. And each of these different species makes some contribution to the stress tensor. And here are the equations classically satisfied following from this action in a hydrodynamic approximation. All of these are pretty obvious, scale equation, Einstein's equation, except maybe for this one. These are really the fluid, basically these are the Euler equations in disguise. It's the fact that this stress tensor TQ would be conserved if it weren't for the interactions of these dark matter particles with the scalar. So on the right-hand side, we have something that would actually vanish if the scalar were frozen to a fixed value, because then M would be frozen to a fixed value. Okay, so let's just take that on faith.
Sorry, doesn't this look like the scenario you have in steady state or quasi steady state cosmology, which was proposed by Boyle and not Descartes?
No. Could easily be. I at the start purposely disavowed my any great familiarity with the cosmology literature of such constructions.
Some your energy momentum tensors presumably satisfy all the nice properties like weak energy conditions.
Absolutely.
So it's not that.
No, but it's exactly the energy momentum conservation.
This isn't the total energy.
That's right. It's if you total up this stress energy tensor overall species plus the scalar stress energy, then these terms are actually arranged precisely in order to give you a conserved stress energy. All right. So I've written down all the all the relevant equations, but what's the physics? The physics is that. The physics is that if we have two objects, like a winding string and another winding string, at different places on our three dimensions, then they experience some attraction due to the presence of this light scalar. And the reason is that this string would like the dimension it wraps to be smaller. This string would like the same thing, and so they like to get together. Whereas if I have a wrapping string and a momentum string, this guy would like the dimension on which it moves to be larger, so they tend to repel. And perhaps it would be a good idea for me to actually write down the force law. I'll just write it big. The scalar force law would be Vm1 phi, Vm2 phi, divided by, well, I don't swear to that 4 pi, but close enough, as compared to force of gravity, which would just be this. So that's why you can have both positive and negative forces here.
So the string circle will be the dark matter particle.
That's the starting proposal. And again, I don't want to be too tied to the Brandenburger-Raphael scenario, although I was inspired by it to work in this problem. In particular, at the end of the day, I don't care what the mass scale of these objects are. All I care about is that the variations in their mass should result in scalar forces that are comparable to gravity.
You do some sort of calculation where you say, give me violation cross-section of these guys, what is their relative abundance at the end of the day?
This is clearly awkward for taking the Brandenburger-Raphael scenario literally, because if you put these very heavy objects, say, above the scale of inflation, then you inflate them away and they're gone. If you put them much below the scale of inflation, like 10 factor of 10 or factor of 100, below the scale of inflation, then you vastly overclose the universe. So there's an extremely narrow range right around the scale of inflation where these things would have the right relative abundance if you do the naive calculation. I'm vaguely aware of some ideas of Rocky Kolb for getting around this sort of thing, but I don't propose to take this kind of question seriously. I'm doing late time cosmology here. And besides, as I said, what I'm going to say it actually doesn't matter so much what the M1 and M2 are. What matters is their derivatives with respect to phi. So if you want to put these at the TEV scale, okay.
I didn't quite understand your answer. Are these strings with dark matter?
Yes.
How do you get the energy density in them to be similar to the critical energy density?
I believe that was essentially Sean's question.
Like, was it? Okay.
And he says, trust us.
Okay. No, I what I say is, to recapitulate, what I say is that this is a familiar problem with dark matter particles, which are far above the preferred TeV scale for WIMPs, but I don't even care because I could put these at the TeV scale. I would just have to then abandon a strict interpretation of them as coming from the Brandenburger-Bopfer scenario. So all I'm saying is inspired by, but not tied to. But these are the dark matter. They do interact by scalars. Those are the points that I hold fast to. Okay? All right, so now we look at some perturbations of the metric, some density contrasts, and we want to know how this perturbation and these perturbations evolve. And that's a very standard sort of calculation to do in linear perturbation theory, so I won't really do it. I will just quote the result that the total density contrast, where these are density fractions, the total density contrast evolves via this equation, and this would be exactly the equation that a cold dark matter person would have told you before I was born, no doubt. And then if you have, let's say, if you have only two species, there's really only one other combination to consider. It turns out more generally that this combination of density contrasts is one that is in some sense orthogonal to the total and evolves simply in linear perturbation theory. And its equation couples to the scalars. And so you have some coupled equations like this. So this looks still a little nasty to solve, and I should explain before I do solve it in an approximation what the parameters are. This zeta 1 is defined like so, and I'll give you a more intuitive definition for this zeta 1 in another transparency or two. Roughly speaking, it measures the strength of the scalar forces. This zeta 2, well, second derivatives of the masses, in some sense it says, do these particles tend to hold phi at a given minimum? We'll mostly be concerned with zeta 1. Okay, so what I really want to do is compare the evolution of this difference of contrasts with this, the total contrast. So the way that I actually proceed is to just say at late times, like matter-dominated epoch, we'll find that in this scalar equation, the derivative term dominates over the other terms on the left-hand side. And so we can then very simply eliminate phi altogether and obtain the equation I've written here for this contrast of contrasts. And so we see it's really of the same form as the evolution equation for the total contrast, and we can find similar power law solutions. So the point is, total contrast grows as conformal times squared, and that's, again, a totally familiar result from cold dark matter models. And this is a big part of what fits so well to what we see. Having a larger power of tau here, if gamma were larger than 1, would be a problem for us. So we should immediately start inquiring, what is the value of gamma that I would predict starting from one consideration or another. So the reason we're going to be mostly concerned with zeta 1 is that only zeta 1 controls the power law dependence of delta. And I promised you a more intuitive notion of what zeta 1 was. Well, here it is. If we have equal matter fractions for two species, and if during structural formation they dominate the universe, so that's, you know, only a temporary equality. And if furthermore our two species have equal masses and opposite derivatives at the equilibrium point, then this zeta 1 is literally just the strength of the scalar force divided by the strength of the gravitational force between two particles. So this illustrates indeed why I can ignore the total scale of M1. If we divide this by this, you see what enters really is not M1, but rather log of M1, and not M2, but log of M2. So you really only care about derivatives of these masses, not their total size. Still, if we got this from string theory, and if we ignore the awkward questions of relic abundances, then it's natural in string theory to get zeta 1 of order 1. And that I find kind of interesting, because it tells us that a simple string construction introduces some extra perturbation equation, which is at the verge of change in the cold dark matter model. So that's why I would say I'm interested.
Is there some reason why this scalar field would not interact merely with gravity?
Would not interact how?
Merely with gravity, applying R. I think it's like coupling to the standard model.
Reasonable question. I don't know. Why do you think it matters?
You ruled out.
On what grounds?
Solar system test of gravity.
Because then you transform to an Einstein frame and.
Now a couple of systems.
Yes, okay. I would take that under the same category of what I'll say a little later, that couplings to the visible sector need to start at dimension 6.
So even to curvature 6.
That's true.
Okay.
But I find this certainly less offensive in the framework of low energy supergravity, where precisely what's coupling to the scalar curvature is the Kalor potential, and you go through a Weyl transformation with the Kalor potential, but the Kalor potential depends quadratically on phi.
But usually you make it massive, right? And usually you don't have massless scalar fields going around at the end of the day and phenomenologically obvious and obvious.
Well, no doubt you have made the same objections to quintessence.
The contribution of string theory would be to provide a reason of why you should have a state like that, a scalar field that doesn't couple to the visible sector. If you could come up with a reason of why this is so, then this would be interesting.
Well, I already came back with an idea, which is that if we start in a framework of low energy supergravity, then the action starts with some power of e to the k in front of r. But k would start as phi squared over m Planck squared.
Okay.
In this context, wouldn't this field with K also couple to visible sector matter?
You're really anticipating the later part of my talk to an extent that I'll have to defer answers. But still, the bottom line is dimension 6, dimension 6, dimension 6. All right. So, I claim to you that Zeta 1 was of the order of unity. And that was supposed to be interesting because then you would get some other type of structure forming at about the same rate as gravitational structure. And that's what could start to let us poke at cold dark matter in a new way. And that's the purpose. So now I want to go back again to admittedly naive ideas from string theory and compute Zeta 1. So perhaps I've included more detail than I needed on this transparency, but let's consider strings on some compact K6, and I'll let myself have some pi 1, and it could be discrete if we choose. Then the way we calculate these string masses is we have to start with a string frame metric, Kaluza Klein reduce it, transform it to Einstein frame, figure out what all our parameters are, like 10-dimensional and 4-dimensional gravitational couplings, and then measure the string masses in this 4-dimensional Einstein frame. And how does it come out? Well, if we assume, taking it as usual, truly the simplest assumptions, that this K6 is some square torus at the self-dual radius, and we let our unstabilized modulus be the size of one of the circles in this T6, then what we get is a dependence of the winding strings and momentum strings on this scalar, as I've indicated. And I've gone ahead and canonically normalized this scalar. And to get that canonical normalization right, I actually did have to follow through the somewhat messy steps. In particular, I had to pay attention to factors in the nonlinear sigma model of scalars that describe the total moduli space of the compactification. Anyway, the claim is that you do it, not difficult, you find that zeta 1 is 2. And, well, coincidentally, zeta 2 is 1, but we don't care about that.
That depends on assuming you're in the self-dual radius.
No, that it does not. Because let's just remember the actual definition I gave for zeta 1. Zeta 1 is going to be the sum over species, as chalk squeaks, sorry, matter fraction times the log mq. D phi squared. So, as a matter of fact, precisely for an exponential dependence, the log is just a linear dependence. So it doesn't matter where phi sits. You'll always get 2.
So this is a Brunt-Sticky theory. What's the omega of this Brunt-Sticky?
I believe that we would be back to questions of how it couples to matter.
It's not quite Brunt-Sticky because it couples differently to dark matter.
I think we're a little stuck on one point, so I hope to get us unstuck when we get to the question of coupling to the visible sector. Okay. Anyway, as Sean says, let's only talk about the dark sector for now. Let's not worry about the visible sector. We have found some zeta 1 of order 1. What does it do to our new combination of density contrasts? Well, it makes it grow very fast. For this thing to grow like tau to the fourth means that bound structures held together by the scalars would form much earlier than gravitational structures.
Sorry, delta was the contrast.
Delta, roughly speaking, delta is this guy. So he doesn't couple linear order to the gravity, because when you get fewer of these, you get more of these, so that your total mass density remains constant. But it does couple to the scalar. And so if I say that this thing starts rising like tau to the fourth, then structures of it will sort of get together, held together, so this is mostly M1s. And this clump of M1s is held together primarily by scalar forces. But once you form these guys, held together mostly by scalars, and you depart from the linear regime, then they'll gravitate, there'll be real structures. This, you know, at higher orders, this will couple to gravity. And so the point is that
delta is growing, but the other one, omega, is fixed. So how can you just do that with M1?
So I have, you mean this one?
Yeah.
Well, I just say they're both growing. They're growing as fast as they naturally want to grow.
Delta grows faster.
So this was, well, we got 4 with our naive computation. And what I'm saying is this won't do. And the reason is that you will form these guys way earlier, some redshift shortly after matter radiation equality, and then there'll be real structures and they'll gravitate and you'll form structure a lot faster. That's the upshot. Okay, so fortunately it takes very little work to adjust zeta 1 downwards. First of all, this calculation depended on details. So just changing the normalization of the scalar, the normalization of its kinetic term would change zeta 1. So it's not at all cast in stone. The point is that string theory could predict a range of zeta 1 close to 1. And that's what I'm interested in, that we can get a range of possible models where this almost is a problem, but maybe not quite. Indeed, that's the punchline for now, that string theory with a free modulus sits close to the border of measurable deviations from the CDM model. Okay. Well, let me, before turning to this issue of coupling to the visible sector, let me go on just a little bit about what we would do, what we could do in the future to make a model that we would test against observation. Well, the crucial question really is, when do structures of this versus structures of this cross into the nonlinear regime? So to figure that out, we have to have some notion of what they are at horizon crossing. A naive guess is that they would be on the same order. That might offend your notions of adiabaticity, because adiabaticity would say that this is much bigger than this. However, when there's a light scalar floating around, I would say the adiabatic assumption is unmotivated, and it's more motivated to suppose that these things are comparable, and these individual constituent contrasts are uncorrelated. So with that assumption of deltas at horizon crossing, then we get some subsequent evolution that looks like this. And we can simply ask at what redshift these guys would cross out of the linear regime. And you get some answer like this. So if gamma is greater than 1, these do cross out earlier. And if gamma is greater than 1 but not much, they cross out a little earlier. And then they form structures that are mostly M1s or else mostly M2s, and then these things subsequently evolve and merge and so forth. But it would be a bit different from cold dark matter. And then another case would be if zeta 1 is less than 1, then admittedly structures of the total density contrast form first. But this will nevertheless be appreciable when those structures form. And so the average bound structure that forms will have some small random charge imbalance, charge in quotes, in the sense that it'll be more M1s than M2s. And again, that means that the structures themselves will experience forces that are not merely gravitational. And so in a bottom-up approach to structure formation, if you've got some of these structures floating around with mostly M1s or mostly M2s, then these guys will merge preferentially with like-charged objects and will tend not to merge with oppositely charged objects. And there you have it. A difference, clearly, from the cold dark matter model. Unfortunately, because this is in the nonlinear regime, I can't tell you without calculating numerically how it will come out, how it will affect the predicted distribution of, say, galaxies today. But this is the point. We get a new parameter to use to poke at the cold dark matter model, and to my way of thinking, that's a good thing.
Looks like a plasma.
A plasma would be different in only one respect, and that is that gauge interactions repel like from like. Scalar interactions attract like from like. So in a plasma, you get Debye screening. Here, you get something like anti-screening. So that's an instability that crops up, and we just have to hope it's not too strong, or we wouldn't be here as we see ourselves today.
Did you say you had to assume non-adiabatic initial condition to do this then?
Well, I told you what I thought was natural. That
I didn't get it because it went too quickly.
I'm sorry.
Suppose I insist on adiabatic initial condition.
So,
what happens then?
In my naive view of cosmology, I pictured the adiabatic condition as arising because there's a universal strength of gravity, and so when you have perturbations of the gravitational potential, things fall into those potential wells more or less the same, depending only on what W they have. Therefore, you get the standard relation between density contrasts for all dust-like particles, you would have delta 1 equals delta 2. That would be adiabaticity for a reason, that the gravity is universal.
We're imposing this at horizon entry. We're talking about the epoch of...
Yes, yes, indeed.
So what happens to your scenario if I insist on adiabatic condition?
It depends on... Then it would depend on details. If you decided to insist on adiabaticity, even though I told you it's unmotivated, then you would have it's measured, but not this non-adiabaticity would not be measured.
See?
Fine. If you had indeed delta much smaller than this, then it starts smaller but it grows faster. So there'd be some competition. If you had some large power like this, I think your goose would still be cooked. You would still find that, you know, unless this were something like 10 to the minus 10th.
That's the non-adiabatic system. Is it?
Yeah. Yes. For this guy to be non-zero is non-adiabatic.
Right. So we insist it's exactly zero sufficiently.
Well, exactly zero. I can't see
sufficiently long before horizon.
I really can't see why the adiabatic assumption would be so holy as to be exact.
Okay. So the thing doesn't work before you do that?
Well, not so. If this were identically zero, then it would work exactly like cold dark matter. Anything that makes this smaller pushes you closer to conventional dark matter.
Right.
So the reason that I say that the adiabatic assumption is unmotivated for these species, as well motivated as it might be for radiation versus matter. The reason I say that it's unmotivated here is that what motivated it in the first place was the universality of gravity, so that curvature perturbations that came from inflation would attract these and these in the same way.
No, it actually has nothing to do with gravity. It's just conservation of energy.
We should indeed. All right. The point, just to finish my sentence at any rate, was that if you have a scalar floating around that couples oppositely to these things and is massless, then I would claim that this equality can be naturally violated without changing adiabaticity in any other sector. But I'll be happy to learn from you later. Okay, so I feel like I should hasten to the discussion of coupling to the visible sector, since that clearly had some of you very concerned. So let me skip over just a bit, straight to that, and say that if scalars don't roll, it seems to me that coupling to the visible sector can be controlled. And the sense in which I mean that is that if we start with the framework of n equals 1, d equals 4 supergravity, and the scalar is part of a superfield, then you've got a Kalor potential whose dependence will start quadratically on phi in some wide range of cases. And then coupling to the visible sector will proceed something like this. And the reason that this is here is precisely because of a Weyl transformation of the type that we would do with a non-minimally coupled scalar. So we start with the natural superfield curvature, and we find that in components it picks up a factor of e to the Kalor potential in front of it. And then there's some Yukawa terms, G, A, Q, U, something like this. There's some Yukawa terms in the action somewhere else. And then we do a conformal transformation, and that, of course, brings factors that were here over here. So this is really the punchline of why I insist that we're not in such grave difficulties when scalars don't roll as we would be with quintessence, that it's natural to assume for some equilibrium value of phi that the couplings here start with phi squared times Yukawa interactions. So now do you feel answered, at least in sense?
No, because what will prevent the scalar field from rolling? If it's mass, then it cannot.
Here is where perhaps I neglected to remind you about Brandenburger's work that he explained at the Superstring Conference in October. If we have some presence of dark matter species whose masses depend oppositely on the scalar, and there's some density fraction of the universe in this species, then they will hold a scalar at a position where their derivatives are equal and opposite. Furthermore, since these are both particles without pressure, their density fractions will always decrease in fixed ratio throughout the radiation-dominated era, for instance. I'm sorry, increase in fixed ratio. So the location of this zero doesn't change. So that's why it's natural for it not to roll. Better?
And the mass of this field, what would it be?
Well, if you're asking what the mass of the field is due to the sort of potential that comes to you from these effects, is that what you're asking? There's no V in the action. What would it be indeed? It's close to the Hubble scale. It's a very small mass. Okay. So maybe once I've written down this one equation, all the argument would focus only on whether I could do that or not. But let me just work through why this makes things better.
Steve?
Yes?
You said it's close to the Hubble scale.
I want to pause to calculate, but at a guess.
Because I thought it was supposed to be constant.
What was supposed to be constant?
Just the value of phi is constant.
No. What Rami was asking about was when you have these different species of dark matter around, let them be winding and wrapping strings, if you like, then their contribution to the effective mass that we see today, that can indeed evolve with the present density of these atoms. Okay. So why do I say this is okay? When you have such a Yukawa coupling after electroweak breaking, when this guy has a VEV, then you wind up with quark masses which depend on phi, but only through phi squared. And so then the proton mass may also depend only on phi squared. You might ask me, what about dependence of the QCD scale on the scalar directly? Well, that's a little subtle, but I would say zeroth order answer is it need not depend on the scalar because gauge couplings are in supersymmetry. They are not sections of a line bundle, but rather functions on the space of scalars. So you don't need to have this exponential decaylor potential modifying them.
So it is not true that all of these couplings came from a formal transformation that started out with only.
Oh, but it is.
So the only coupling that you started with came from.
I'm just saying, right, I'm just following the conventional track of supergravity. N equals 1, d equals 4 supergravity.
So you start with just a coupling to R, or do you also have direct couplings to
just a coupling to R.
And there are never any violations of the equation. And you should just plug it into the PPM parameters to see if it's okay in solar system. Can't violate the equivalence principle if there's a unique metric that couples to all that before or after.
I'll have to think about that one. I see what you mean.
And the other forces. This is a massless scalar that don't couple.
Yes, yeah, so he has a massless scalar that only couples to dark matter and to the Ricci scalar. So you get a new, you'll get, in principle, you have to calculate and practice how big it is, but you'll get modifications of GR in the solar system that you'll test by bouncing radar signals off of the moon and of Mars and so forth. But you'll never get a fifth force that's composition dependent, because there is a frame in which the scalar field doesn't talk to the matter.
Well, that is where I'm aiming. I'm just having a little trouble more prosaically starting with this kind of dependence of Yukawa couplings.
Well, you've made it terribly complicated. You're going to get many different
choices. I know.
Because you're going to get couplings to QCD, to separately to quarks, and to leptons and so forth. And they will all exactly cancel if you could do the calculations well.
In the frame that you're speaking of. Well, I will certainly. I certainly understand the point. I'll have to look at that. Fine, thank you. Okay.
So why should there be violations of the orbital motion?
Well, you have a massless scalar field coupled to gravity. It's a version of Brown's
decay. Because Brown's decay couples to all matter as well.
That's a frame-dependent statement. There's a frame in which it only couples to gravity. And so the experiments have already been done. You'll predict a certain set of parameters that tell you how much you deviate with your own soul. You can straightforwardly compare that.
So you're saying it's just Brown's decay.
As far as the visible sector is concerned, it's just
where his omega is something like phi squared over x squared.
Zero.
This W.
The way that he presented it is zero.
What?
The conventionally defined W is when you have a non-canonically normalized kinetic term. So it's not obvious, of course, but I think it's going to be a number where you can have 1 or 0 or something.
But then it's rolled out.
Yes.
Forget that.
It
used to be 500, and now it's up in the top.
But it will depend on the details, so it needs to be.
Well, I certainly look forward to talking more about that. Since I am running short of time, I think I should perhaps skip to some informal discussion. Maybe I can turn on the lights for the blackboard. So I just want to make a short point about how I violated naturalness and how I've not. Well, first of all, the mass of my scalar really has to be big. I'm sorry, the inverse mass of my scalar has to be quite big in order to actually play a role in structure formation. If I don't violate, if I don't have this inequality, we'll just be back to CDM. And obviously, from a particle physics point of view, that's a monumentally small mass. Nevertheless, for a globally supersymmetric theory, m phi equals 0 is natural. We could just forbid no m phi squared term in W, and it doesn't come back to us in loops. Furthermore, my other remarks, like having zeta 1 on the order of unity, they basically depend on having the Lagrangian for dark matter look something like this. Let's just imagine the dark matter is some collection of massive fermions. So this, I could equally well do bosons, but let's just write fermions. So if we have several species of fermions with phi-dependent masses, then the natural thing to do is to say that mk of phi is some bare mass plus some scalar-dependent piece suppressed by M Planck with a coupling of order unity. And if you work things out, you find that zeta 1 is on the order of the typical y squared. And so just considerations of naturalness would tell me that zeta 1 is of order 1. So in that way, I have not done anything that a Wilsonian field theorist would object to. Of course, where I have is I've said that I want this inequality to persist even after supersymmetry breaking. So after Suzy breaking, then naturalness would guide me. To a mass for phi, which is greater than about 0.1 eV. And that's based on the notion that we could break supersymmetry in some way at maybe 10 TeV, gauge mediate its effects to the visible sector, and then let gravity mediation give us the supersymmetry breaking in this dark sector. But even if you have that weakest of supersymmetry breaking, you still wind up with a much different scalar mass as compared to this. So again, I would say I have done something which is unnatural after supersymmetry breaking, but I don't consider that a terrible sin, since the cosmological constant itself is terribly unnatural after supersymmetry breaking. Okay, so that's really enough for me to say. Let me now just wrap up with conclusions. Please.
Something before you get to conclusions, there's something in the introduction I sort of left out, which is what is wrong with lambda CDM?
And no theory should have it all. We've
talked about this before. I mean, there should be something in the dark sector. But what problems is he trying to solve?
The first thing I would say is that no theory should have it all its own way. Precisely when a theory is working really, really well, you should poke at it with other alternatives, like the Debye theory in condensed matter, a perfect example. But to answer you straightforwardly, I am told by our very own Lars Bilston that problems that CDM seems like it might have are explaining black holes in the center of galaxies, explaining the lack of dwarf galaxies. These are iffy kind of problems. People debate whether they're really an issue or not. The one where this might be an interesting alternative to consider is black holes in the center of galaxies, because if you have these scalar forces, they could cause black hole formation more quickly. Perhaps there's something to say there. But again, it's way into the nonlinear regime, so I can't just calculate on my fingers and tell you what's going to happen. Still,
I thought the other attempts to solve the problems in the course of galaxies, the problems have to do with the cuspiness of the matter distribution, and other attempts have made the dark matter repulsive in order to do that. And you're saying that by making it attractive,
I didn't say I was going to solve the Cuss problem this way. I said that black holes at the center of galaxies might have some affinity to this type of extra force.
I think the motivation for the Lenz Farrar paper was mostly on the dark energy side, you know, an attempt to make dark energy a little bit more concrete and realistic, in a sense. It's a field that doesn't just invent it for the cosmological behavior, but has some interactions with particles and has a Lagrangian and so on.
So it's not supposed to be solving any of the problems.
There's certainly no phenomenon which is strongly inconsistent with lambda CDM. Just because a theory hasn't been ruled out doesn't mean it's right. So we should try to understand space of possibility. I think that's the best motivation.
Right, and indeed the first one that I get. And besides, to my way of thinking, with our ability to stabilize string moduli, relying only on this KKLT construction, which is very ornate and complicated, I think it's only reasonable to inquire what are the possible effects if we wouldn't stabilize some string moduli. Well, we all know that coupling to the visible sector is going to be a horrible problem if you have light scalars in the coupled dimension 5, but I've tried to point out that if you forbid couplings up until dimension 6 in the visible sector but not the dark sector, then you can tolerate an unstabilized modulus, and it could even be interesting. So So that's another way to slice the motivations. You look unhappy, Tom.
No, stabilization of moduli only looks ornate because you're, in KKLT, because you're forcing yourself to do it in recoupling. If you think of generic regions of moduli space and you think about n equals 1 supergravity, then in fact you expect moduli to always be stabilized because the number of equations you need is equal to the number of unknowns. And there's absolutely, generically, no reason for there to be any moduli that are left massless. Okay, it's only because of the very special forms that things have, these exponential dependencies of things in the weak coupling or large radius regimes, that there's a problem, which was then solved by all of this work on flux convective decay. So it's only in that regime that it looks so peculiar.
And yet we have a certain affinity for recoupling.
That's just because we're lasers.
No, it's because alpha equals 1 over 137.
Oh, that can be explained without being in weakly coupled string.
Sorry, David, did you say that's time dependent? Yeah. All right, well, most of my conclusions have been anticipated in the discussion. And the slides, you can't see them. But to recap, I considered scalar forces on the same order of strength as gravity. I point out that I'd like to poke not just at inflation with string theory, I'd like to poke at every aspect of cosmology. And with an unstabilized modulus, there seems to be some modifications to cold dark matter that might matter to observation. Thanks.